This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your total experience in podcasting of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. It has been another week of ongoing turmoil in the world, in the country. This is not going to be a surprise to anybody. Continued protests, continued facing up to police violence, and the conversations are broadening. They're spreading out. There have been these kind of convulsions in the journalism field, and there also have been these convulsions in the music business. And been keeping an eye on what record labels and entities in the music industry have been talking about and doing, and trying to figure out if it's more than just lip service. You know, we've had a whole range of institutional and individual responses. You've had the blackout Instagram post and kind of how that ended up missing the mark in some ways, especially with what it did to the Black Lives Matter hashtag. You've had individual record labels announcing initiatives and donations and promising to do better in terms of how they treat their Black employees, and presumably to look deep within and figure out what kind of inequities exist between how they market Black music, how they market white music, and so on. You know, it's tough to say right now how these things are going to play out long term. Giving money up front is a worthwhile step. That's a good first step. Looking in the mirror and saying, are we treating our Black executives, our other non-white executives, the same way that we treat our white executives and employees across the board? Those are worthy questions. And I'm hoping to see more and louder response from record labels, especially in the coming weeks. But there is one thing that has been happening. It's been happening quickly. It's been unfolding fast. And that is the conversation around the word urban. And you've had record labels, Republic publicly, I believe Warner also not publicly, and I'm not sure, but someone had reported that they were intending to do this too, which is to say dropping urban from their department titles. You have the Grammys, which have just released their category lists for the next Grammy Awards and have removed urban from most of the categories, although then they did add one in the Latin music space. You also have some pushback in that world against the term urbano and that umbrella term for kind of all these different styles of music. And the issue in all of these situations is the same, which is that urban has, of course, become an ill-fitting euphemism for Black music or music derived from the Black experience, music that builds upon the foundation of Black creators. And it's become a catch-all and a way for people to kind of, I would say, dodge the ethical responsibility to talk about what the music actually is. But on the other hand, I was also thinking about how long that term has been in use, and also the multiplicity of ways in which it's been used. There is not and has not been one specific understanding of urban as a category, as a phrase. And so on this episode of Popcast, what I wanted to do is actually talk about the history of that term, where it comes from, when it was first deployed, and how its meaning has changed over the last few decades. And so I was doing a bunch of reading, having conversations with folks who work in radio or radio adjacent fields, and all of the conversations and all of the reading points back to the late 70s and early 80s. And we're going to talk briefly before we get with today's guest, who's Nelson George, who was covering a lot of these concerns at Billboard in the early 80s. We're going to talk a little bit about Frankie Crocker. Frankie Crocker, if you don't know, was a program director and disc jockey at a number of stations in the 70s, but most importantly at WBLS in New York. And when he took over in 1972, I believe, he went about remaking what the sound of that station is. It had been a very soul music forward playlists prior to that, and he started to change the sound. There's a book that I recommend. It's called Voiceover, The Making of Black Radio. It's by William Barlow. I tried to track William Barlow down. I was unable to, unfortunately, but I do have this book. And so I want to talk about Frankie Crocker's idea for radio programming that became known as urban contemporary. So I'm going to read for a minute from the Barlow book. Frankie Crocker's own afternoon drive time music show on WBLS established the station's new format in terms of both content and style. His playlists featured the best-selling jazz artists of the day, such as Grover Washington Jr., who we played at the beginning of the show, and Weather Report. Conspicuously absent were the avant-garde jazz releases favored by his predecessor. In addition, Crocker showcased the music of such high-profile R&B artists as Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and Isaac Hayes, and he blended into this mix the latest disco dance tracks popular in local nightclubs. As for his style, Crocker perfected an on-air delivery that came to epitomize black, upwardly mobile New York City hipness. It was mellow, suave, and seductive all at once. He went by the radio name Hollywood. And then there's a bunch more after that. But it shows Crocker expanding the radio programming idea of what a station like WBLS could deliver. And there was a tension between what Crocker was doing and what older DJs were doing and other black radio stations of that era were doing. But Crocker was very successful. And a number of other stations in New York and also in other cities started to emulate what Crocker was doing. That style started to be called urban contemporary. That became even more the case as Crocker expanded the BLS playlist to include white artists making black adjacent music. And part of the reason that he was doing that is because he had an expansive idea of how black musical ideas were traveling through the pop world and through the mainstream world. Crocker was someone who had a history, a radio history at both mainstream pop stations and also soul music stations. So partially that's what he was doing, but also he wanted to attract, I mean, as the person who was programming the station, he wanted to attract higher end advertisers. And this is something that they talk about quite a bit in the Barlow book. And in Nelson George's book, we're going to talk to Nelson about this, his book, The Death of Rhythm and Blues, there's conversation about how expanding the format of the songs played on BLS and stations like it was partially designed by people who wanted to bring in advertisers that had historically not come to black radio stations. So urban and urban contemporary became this kind of catch-all phrase for that kind of playlist approach. But then what we saw throughout the, especially pushing into the 90s and beyond, urban becomes kind of an empty umbrella phrase. R&B is under it. Hip hop is under it. And then it became a language that was adopted not only by radio stations, the people who collect chart information for radio stations, but also at record labels where urban music departments sort of euphemistically were the hip hop department or the R&B department. And so the term has meant different things at different parts of the last 40 or so years. But because it's meant different things to different people, it's increasingly coming to mean nothing. And so because it's a euphemism and because it's imperfect, in this moment, it seems particularly ill-suited for the needs and wants of a generation of music executives, of music fans who are very, very clear that the music that they are supporting and that they are fans of is black music, music made by black people. And so because of that, getting rid of urban is an easy fix. And hopefully will be one step that the music industry can take towards getting rid of its skittishness around addressing race and racial equity in the industry. So this week, we're going to talk to Nelson George about the introduction of the idea of urban contemporary music and how the term urban has changed in the decades since. Nelson is a screenwriter, a longtime music journalist. He's back with us on Popcast. You may remember he was with us for the Village Voice Remembrance Popcast. And most notably for our conversation today, Nelson was covering radio, black radio at Billboard in the early 80s. Nelson is also the author of The Death of Rhythm and Blues, which I was glad to have an excuse to pull off the shelf. Nelson, you're looking real good on the back cover of this book, I'll say that.
That was on a rooftop in London, actually.
Wow.
Now, which one was that? You had the hardcover or the paperback?
I got the paperback with the, you got the coat with the collar up and the hat,
yeah.
Like fedora. Yeah, this is anybody who wants guidance for an author photo, please take a look at this photo. You can learn a lot from it.
That was literally taken on rooftop in London. That's hilarious.
It's giving me very big rooftop in London energy. So I believe that story. As you've undoubtedly seen over the last couple weeks, there's been just a tremendous amount of reckoning with the nomenclature of urban and how urban is used in radio stations, at record labels, this kind of euphemistic shorthand that is also carries a lot of baggage with it. But one thing I know from reading your coverage from the 80s and reading the sections of Death of Rhythm and Blues about that time period is there was a similar debate at the time. And I wonder if we can start off by talking about Frankie Crocker. And Frankie Crocker at WBLS in the mid-70s and what he was attempting to do with black radio that had not previously been done.
Well, you know, it's the mid-70s. BLS is part of a wave of black FM stations that have recalibrated the sound of black music. And when I say that, I'm talking about BLS in New York, WDAS in Philadelphia, WHUR in DC, and many other stations around the country were black FM stations that started in the early 70s, which meant that the sound quality and the fidelity that people experienced black music in on radio had improved tremendously from the old AM stations that used to dominate it in the 50s and 60s. With that new sound, Frankie conceived a new way to present black radio. So black radio before Frankie had been defined by fast-talking, jive-talking DJs. And Frankie himself had been one of those people. There's tapes of him doing that. He came up with a more sophisticated, I would call it the Harvey's Bristol Cream of radio, which is a smoother, more relaxed style. Along with Frankie's innovations in sound and approach, there was a thing called the Quiet Storm out of DC, which was this idea that black music was more sophisticated and the audience deserved a more sophisticated presentation. And that ties into, Gamblin' Huff's Philly Sound. It ties into what Barry White was doing. It ties into Isaac Hayes. There was a whole sonic explosion that went along with this. Album-oriented R&B, which really hadn't existed till the 70s.
The lushness of these records in the mid to late 70s setting the table for disco, which obviously is going to take that to its logical conclusion. But the lushness of these mid 70s records also kind of de-emphasizing some of the classic, like the almost like the intense herky jerkiness of the soul, like post James Brown soul music, smoothing that out, giving it these signifiers.
And then also, the technology, because then you have the transitions happening in the music from the band idea and slowly the technology that Stevie Wonder brought in with the Moog synthesizer and so forth. Bands like Earth, Wind & Fire, P-Funk, all the progressive forces in the music are using this technology more and more and changing the sound, and drum machines come in. All of this sets the framework for Frankie and BLS really being in the vanguard of using this new black music and also opening the playlist so that I Miss You by the Rolling Stones or Another One Bites the Dust by Queen or any of those kind of records that were white artists doing sort of R&B or soul-based music, funk-based music, he played those records too. And so BLS becomes the number one station in New York.
We were talking briefly about the William Barlow book, the voiceover book, and he points out something that I had not been aware of, which is that you had the tagline of BLS in the early Frankie Crocker days, which is the total black experience and sound. And then that gets reframed as the total experience and sound as he's opening up the playlists.
He also used the phrase the world's best looking sound.
Mm.
His argument was, and it was very smart, New York is a multicultural melting pot. So I can play Soul Makusa, and I can play Saron Supernature, and I can play Bounce Rock Skate Roll by Von Mason, and it's all part of what New York is. And as using that idea, he basically knocked the old AM station. ABC had been the number one music station in New York for decades, and rearranged the entire way that New York radio sounded.
Was he the person who actually coined the phrase urban contemporary? Do you remember the genesis of that phrase?
You know, it's funny because the word urban as a signifier for a code word for black had been around, and some corporations had used the phrase urban, I believe, before that. It had been sort of around in the early 70s. It's a marketing term. It's important actually to talk about what that meant at that time. To marketers and to Frankie, urban meant black and white listeners. The idea was that the urban experience was a city experience that this music and the culture of a city like New York or Philadelphia or DC reflected, not that his listeners, and this is the key point, that his listeners were white as well as black. And the reason this is important is because it comes down to business. BLS, they really were irritated. We're the number one station, or we're close to number one or number two, depending on which ratings book. But we're not getting the advertisers. We're not getting the car companies. We're not getting the airline ads that, let's say, a white station that's not as good as we are is getting. And that was also true in Philadelphia, D.C., and all these major markets where these urban stations were challenging, either number one or challenging for number one. So urban was for them was a way to try and seduce advertisers, soften the blow or the idea of selling to black consumers, and to make these executives understand that white people were part of the urban audience. And that was a big part of the pitch, that we're a black-based station that appeals to all New Yorkers.
Was that a radical concept? I would have assumed in the wake of the 60s and the early 70s, with the intense popularity of soul music across demographic lines, that wouldn't have been a radical proposition for a radio station or a radio programmer to kind of carry out into the world.
It wasn't a radio station the problem was with. The problem was the advertisers. You had to convince mainstream advertisers to buy ad time on black radio stations. And so urban was a strategic term to convince these advertisers, or seduce them, I always say, to, no, it's not so bad. Come over here. I mean, Frankie, if you remember if you read any of his interviews for the time, he talks about gays. He talks about Latinos. He talks about the fact that his station was a New York station, and that for him, urban was a way to bring people into the tent, not to push them out.
You have a quote I want to read from, this is from your book, from Sonny Joe White from Kiss FM in Boston, and talking about the term urban. And here's what he says. He says, it's a marketing problem, unfortunately. Many advertising agencies still seem to believe there is no black middle class, and they know very little about the buying habits of today's black consumer. So stations call themselves urban to make themselves more attractive to those agencies, which would never buy a black station. Such stereotype thinking forces even black stations to downplay their blackness in order to compete for advertising dollars. Right or wrong, urban is a more acceptable term to these agency people.
Absolutely. So it was a very pragmatic decision that Frankie, for example, was able to frame as a musical decision. But it really came down to how do I take the success I'm having and convince very reluctant people on Madison Avenue that we deserve to our listeners will buy your product. We can't afford to buy your product. So that drove a lot of that. And so once Frank and Urban Contemporary, I think it's important, it wasn't simply urban. Urban contemporary was this idea that it was new music and new style. It's not the city is being transformed, and we are part of that. The record companies began adopting it. Previously, they had blank music departments, and that was actually a fairly recent thing. It only really started in big way around 69-70, where these autonomous sections were really designed to market and promote black music to the height, you know, with the marketing power of a CBS or RCA or MCA behind them. So all of these black music departments became urban departments and urban contemporary departments. And so the phrase, I would say it started in mainstream companies, this idea of urban divisions. Then it transferred, Frankie adopted it. I think he put the contemporary on it. And then it kind of became a catch-all for all kinds of ways of doing with black music. I'll tell you a story. I was at Billboard, you know, as you said, in the early 80s. And one of the big debates we had was we clearly by 82 or 83, and with the rise of hip hop and some other things happening with black music, the idea of R&B charts seemed kind of, at the time, seemed a little, I think we called it the soul chart at that point. You know, obviously it wasn't soul music anymore, right? And I remember I got a lot of flack because I was one of the advocates at Billboard. We called it the black music charts at a certain time. And that got a lot of pushback from the labels because they felt like we were making a sound into a race. My argument was, well, the race produces the sound. But moreover, there wasn't really, at that point in time, a really acceptable catch-all for what to call the music that was being created out of Black America. It was really spiraling to many different directions. And that's one of the reasons that urban, I think, caught on, was that clearly we weren't doing soul music. It wasn't just funk. Some of it was what Prince was doing. Some of it was what Michael Jackson was doing. Some of it was what the Gap Band was doing. So, you know, and then you had people like Shalimar. So what describes all of that music? So I think that one of the things that from this moment that connects to the past is, okay, where are we now? Where is this music? And how do we define it? And that's always been a struggle with black music historically.
That goes back to the days of quote-unquote race records and things of that nature, you know. And, you know, nomenclature is definitionally imperfect because it's someone's attempt to put a label on a thing that does not have firm edges. So nomenclature, generally speaking, is always going to be flawed. But one thing that I was curious about from that time period is, if there was already these debates happening between some people embracing the idea of urban as a way of promoting a cosmopolitan idea of what either black life could be or black music could be, or that it was more open-eared and taking in white artists in a formatting framework, but there were other people who said, well, actually, you're just kind of hiding the truth. This is black music. Why are you giving it this euphemistic term? If there was already that debate happening in 81, 82, 83, why do you think the term urban survived that debate?
Because there was no other universally accepted word. So, you know, Chuck D famously at the beginning of Public Enemy, you know, this is black radio quite a bit in a lot of his records. Radio, suckers never play me. It's because by then the radio formats had become so wedded to a kind of cosmopolitan style that the rawer sounds that hip hop brought were anathema to the program directors. Also because they were as anathema to the sales department who were like, we can't sell Cadillacs or we can't sell trips to Jamaica playing, you know, Don't Believe the Hype.
Little did they know.
But they didn't know. I mean, but you remember that's a journey that took years. That didn't happen overnight. That's a 10-year journey, I think. So everyone sort of agreed what R&B was, and everyone kind of agreed what soul music was. But after that, it's been a free-for-all. So urban survived because the music kept mutating so quickly. I mean, at some point, now here's what's funny to me, is that there's now a world where anybody young who made a record for a long time, even if they were singers, were considered hip-hop. That went on for quite a while. And I always thought that was ridiculous. I always thought by defining everything through hip hop, you again kind of imposed a self-segregation on what Black music was. They didn't leave a lot of room for, you know, until this new wave of, I don't know, Her and Anderson .Paak and Daniel Caesar. There was a long period there where, you know, someone like R. Kelly was as much connected to hip-hop as he was to R&B. And I think that that has broken. I think that has broken. But it took a long time.
Well, I mean, well, the way that hip-hop absorbed R&B in the 90s, you know, just sort of took the structural properties and the kind of the sonic properties and just kind of absorbed it and said, well, we don't need to sample. We're just going to become quasi R&B and then absorb it. And then if you're an R&B singer, all of a sudden the opportunities that were there for you maybe are there less because hip hop has kind of come and like taken that plate a little bit.
And also the irony is the radio part of it is that the Black radio that existed into the 21st century became kidnapped by hip hop. So that if you're Maxwell or D'Angelo or Jill Scott, for example, that whole generation, while you're making records, the world of radio stations that played your records began disappearing.
Right.
So there was no place for it. You know, an adult R&B, you know, by fairly young artists, you know, we're talking about people who at that point were probably in their 30s. They suddenly looked up and those places that in 95 played their records didn't really exist by, you know, 2003.
I was talking to some folks yesterday and today just to kind of get my head around radio formatting and how that evolved through the 80s. And one thing that I was told, which I thought was pretty striking, was, you know, you had urban contemporary as a formal or informal format from the early 80s through the mid 80s. And then with the rise of early Hot 97, you know, say the late 80s into the early 90s, Power 106 in LA, those stations pushed back against being called urban because to them, urban was essentially their parents' music.
That goes back to my point that the actual, again, nomenclature for the music fractured so that there was no consensus. And that's why urban has lived so long, because there was no consensus really about what this music was anymore. And also who listened to it, because everyone was so shocked that when I remember when the second NWA album came out and it went number one immediately on the Billboard chart. And they when they looked at where the sales were, so much the sales at these sort of sales in the suburbs were right rock bands sold. NWA sold like a heavy metal band, and it shocked people. So that idea that there's a white audience that's embracing that music, a young white audience, that now essentially if you look, think about it, those people who bought NWA when they were 16 or 17 grew up with that kind of music, and they are tastemakers now, or they're raising their kids on, you know, who listened to the latest guy with Little in his first name. You know, that's the shift that happened. So I just think that urban was comfortable. Everyone knew what it was, and a kind of a general consensus that it was Black music of some kind or Black bass music. The question now becomes, you know, if you want to replace it, what do you replace it with that actually makes any sense?
Well, before we even get to that, because that's, I do want to talk that question, but an interesting thing happens with the urban music framework in the 90s into the 2000s, which is, you know, the Frankie Crocker version of what that word means and how he's applying it is not the same as what rap labels and mainstream record labels in the 90s and 2000s. It's not this, they use urban, but they're using it to describe a different kind of music. They're doing it to describe, in essence, you know, post Bad Boy and Death Row hip hop, which is sort of has a little bit of pop texture to it, but is essentially just straight hip hop. And I think one of the things that's so challenging is when people are saying urban is not an appropriately reflective term, it doesn't capture Black music in its fullness, it doesn't even adequately represent Black contemporary Black music. Urban is also a moving target on its own. Urban is also a word that means different things to your generation, to my generation, to younger people's generations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the idea of replacing it, it's basically the same impulse I had when I got to Billboard in the early 80s and wanted them to change the soul charts to like Black music. because I was trying to, I knew that what existed didn't work. But, you know, what I came up with was imperfect and got a lot of pushback for some of the same reasons. People thought it was too limiting. You can't make music of color. So, you know, I think that that's the, this is an internal debate. You know, here's one of the funny things to me, ironies, is that you look at country music. First they were country and Western, right? They got rid of the Western and they stayed country. And even though their music has evolved 360 degrees from Hank Williams, they have stayed with the same name. Because to them, they've embraced the idea that this country means, country music means certain things that everyone knows what they mean. They mean, it means white folks, usually. It means certain values.
Rural or rural adjacent.
Right. And so what the original urban thing was, it's in a way to try and come up with a phrase like country. But because that's a very conservative, not very forward-thinking group, they have managed to stay under that umbrella for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. Black music has never been that complacent. It's always a forward-moving target. It's always on to the next and discarding the past pretty quickly. Things become out of style in black music in a heartbeat. Because it's constantly been morphing, it continues to morph. This will always be a debate, I think, because the music changes. And, you know, you have this, I think the phrase that came up was progressive R&B. Well, I think the Grammys have just floated that for one of the categories.
Right, because they're removing urban from all those category names.
Right.
Yeah.
I think progressive R&B is, it's fine for her and Anderson .Paak. And I think, it kind of works as long as you understand, but you'll have to agree what R&B is.
But also, work. Although, to be honest, one thing I struggle with about the progressive framing is I don't consider the R&B that's not her or Anderson .Paak to not be a progressive art form. You know, like it's when you start sort of saying, you know, it's like when people would say that, like what Bad Boy was doing was somehow not radical. You know, of course it was radical. It was structured maybe closer to pop frameworks than the more adventurous minded, you know, lyrically dexterity focused MCs of the underground. But it's not, you can't say that the music itself wasn't in some way radical or progressive. So I always get a little skeptical of that because it makes me worry that like that's sort of a backhanded compliment. That's a backhanded insult to everybody who doesn't fit into that category.
Well, I mean, that's going to be it. So you got, let's say you have one, let's say next year at the Grammys, you got her new record, you have Beyonce, and you have Maxwell. They're black singers singing songs. But I would tell you, Maxwell, who's been very consistent about staying in his lane, you know, is very comfortable doing what he does and has a really cultivated, a really nice, loyal audience for that over 20-some-odd years. Beyonce's doing, you know, Beyonce is, you know, trying to go for global world domination. And, you know, her is trying to find her voice or space and all this and who, you know. So they're very radical. And you think about them, their audiences and their artistic approaches are radically different.
Absolutely. You know, and it's interesting because even someone like Maxwell, in his day, you know, on album one, you know, Urban Hang Suite era, maybe that's a quote unquote progressive, if we are even using those terms. Maxwell in 2020, that's heritage music at this point. So is it somehow not progressive just because it's been around a long time? That's why like those kind of designations kind of cause me some agita a little bit.
Yeah. So I don't know. So in other words, If you got a bunch of people around the table now, I'm sure people are having these conversations and tried to figure out, well, what the hell do we call this? And how do we slice these things up? I don't know. I remember when Drake got upset for being in the hip hop category, but because he kind of quote unquote sings, you know, it's a strong argument. He does make some, depending on the record he puts out. So I do think that the actual diversity of what black music is, as I call it, black music. Music comes from black people and comes from black experience in America. It's very hard to put, it's hard to pin down. And it has been for a long time.
Would you rather just see the end of all euphemisms like urban, even R&B has become a genre name, but just anything euphemistic and just strictly call it black music? Or would you like to see here's a hip hop chart, here's an R&B chart, without even kind of trying to micro split hairs between progressive and classic or any of that stuff. Is that where do you think it should go?
I'm not sure. I just know this, that it may be because I'm older now and I have this perspective. I used to see all of these things, you know, there's the hip hop era and there's the R&B era and there's soul and funk. And there are specific moments when certain styles of music rise up. But I all see them as projections of Black music right now. I really see them. I don't really see them as broken up as I used to as I was younger. I think part of being an adherent of any of these music is always an oppositional stance to the other music. You know what I mean? So you call your music New Jack Swing because it's not Freddie Jackson.
Right, yes.
Or you call yourself, you know, or trap music because we're not doing Pete Rock sounds. We're doing
exactly.
So a big part of these designations is a self-definition against something that existed. But then once you start having that fragmenting, it's hard to have an affirmative phrase that everyone can agree to. I mean, even hip hop.
You used to call me on my. You used to. Yeah. You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
And you brought up the Drake example, which I think is actually very instructive, because one thing that I feel like I spend a lot of time thinking about is how once a genre box has been created, so many things can happen inside that box that the name somehow doesn't capture. So when I think of hip hop in the contemporary sense, I'm thinking of people who sing. I'm thinking of people who sing and rap. I'm thinking of people who melt those two things together. So for Drake to say, it's strange for me to get a best rap song Grammy for a song that has no rapping on it, purely speaking, from a technical perspective, I know that that's correct from a technical perspective. But I also know that when I think of rap music circa the mid-2010s, what I'm thinking of is Drake-influenced, melodic, singing-forward music. And so it maybe is not totally surprising that an institution like the Grammys would say, okay, well, Drake is an innovator, the current pioneer of that style, the person who's pushing the sound, he fits in this rap category. Look, I think most of these categories are trash regardless, but I can understand that logic if someone were to tell me that that was the logic.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, almost all the terms are behind the artist. I mean, in other words, we come up with it after the artist has already pushed the thing forward.
After they've made the choice, after they've made the sound.
To me personally, I love all these designations, actually. I think they're fun. I mean, they may not be good for marketing, but I'm not a marketer. I don't care. Because people use these names to create their own community. And that's what gets left out of this. All these different phrases, trap. Trap is a way to say, this is who we are and we're not you. So to me, as a writer, I love all of that. And as a music fan, I love all of that. I love someone turning me on to a whole cult or underground scene that dives into this thing and has made this theirs. The problem that happens to all of these things and the challenge for the original fans and is that if it's really good, it begins influencing other artists who want to try that sound out. And that's when we get into these, it begins getting diffuse. So I mean, I'm a fan of all of these different designations, actually.
Do you feel, though, now that we've been through, you know, umpteen cycles of people saying that the term urban is too specific, not specific enough, captures an imperfect picture of what Black music is, captures a too expansive idea of what music is. Since I feel like it's been abused from so many different angles in just so many different ways. I mean, look, we know it's code. It's coded language. We know that. Because we are far enough down the arc of history that we can all, even the people who embrace the idea of an urban music department, probably can look you in the eye and say, yes, we know it's coded language. Is it not the right time for what's happening to happen, which is for people to say, no more, we're not doing. Even if it started with good intentions or different intentions, it's been bastardized.
What we're seeing is also a manifestation of a generation that grew up without program radio. So you're, you know, SoundCloud kids, people who grew up on YouTube, they're just picking and choosing and pulling things. And the music reflects that. So if it's their determination that none of these genres are relevant to them, then they can go ahead and manifest that. And that's also good for the universalist artist who wants to be Beyonce or who wants to have that global reach. A lot of people just want to satisfy their friends and make it an exclusive party. So I think that the challenge comes not with the big artists who are gonna, you know, who have ambitions of global domination. But what about people who really are niche artists who want to make niche music for their fans? And they want to have a term that helps unite their community. That's where it's gonna run into not problems, but there'll be different contradictions that come out of it. I mean, because as we just said, progressive R&B is like, it's both more specific and vaguer than urban in a strange way. And also with indies, one of the issues that we're not talking about this one is this issue of employment. Going all the way back to the beginnings, when they had Black music departments, they were created in major labels that had never really supported Black music. So that the Motowns, the Atlantics, the Staxes were sort of replaced by these Black music departments at CBS, RCA, Warner Brothers, etc. And the Earth, Wind & Fires and a lot of the Michael Jackson, a lot of the big pop explosion that happened in the 70s into the 80s was driven by the development of these departments that helped nurture these artists. The real argument that a lot of people who are in the industry have about urban was that it meant that these Black executives, there was a limit to what they could do. They weren't allowed to deal with white artists at all. And when Black artists crossed over, they weren't really part of that party. And I do think that one of the things that is missing in the current landscape were the fact that we had Uptown, Def Jam, Bad Boy, and on. There were all of these sort of boutique Black-owned entities that manifested a very specific taste of their entrepreneurs and the people at that particular boutique. And they created a sound and they created style out of it. And right now, and also they did artist development. So that, you know, one of the funny things that happens today is that you have young Black artists who have a big record and boom, they've never been on stage before and they're, you know, playing arenas almost. That was something that the Andre Harrells, you know, the late Andre Harrell.
Rest in peace. Yep.
And people like that, you know, Baby in His Own Way was what he did. You know, all of these different entities, it seems like there's still a need, I believe, for culturally sensitive people who understand the market, understand the music, to be more engaged, and not just in every stage of that career. So what's really going to have to be seen is, will this removal of urban also go with an empowerment of young executives who can bring the full weight of the culture to the labels and not just to be segmented.
And also, I mean, you mentioned Uptown, Bad Boy, Into Cash Money. I mean, I think what you saw with rappers kind of in the post Cash Money, No Limit era, you know, we used to write, when I was writing for XXL or The Source, you know, a lot of the artists that we'd write about were basically on labels that were regional labels signed to major distribution. But at a certain point, those artists became so lucrative that the majors just started trying to go and get those artists directly. They didn't want to necessarily partner with another label. They wanted to go and get them signed directly. But a lot of times those artists would come into the major labels and, as you say, not have the institutional support because the labels did not have the right staffing to be able to support careers like that.
No, I mean, A&R, you know, what basically, in a strange way, those labels were the last bastion of A&R because they were people who had specific tastes.
Ground level.
And an understanding of their audience and how the guy should look and how the artist should move was all a big part of what these guys did. I mean, you know, one of the biggest decisions ever made was to get Jodeci into boots and overall, you know, and caps and supposed to wearing suits and help change R&B. In this new environment, there may be an opportunity to empower other young executives to have more autonomy from beginning to end with these artists. Because I think that's what to me is missing.
I think that's totally fair. Before we go, this is actually the second time that we've spoken recently. We did talk recently to celebrate the life of Rocky Ford. And I wonder if you would say a few words about him. You know, Rocky was one of your mentors. And for the listeners, if you have not read the obituary that I wrote about Rocky, Rocky was the first person to write about hip hop as we now understand it in a mainstream publication in Billboard in 1978, right around when Nelson was writing for the Amsterdam News. And Rocky went on to work with Curtis Blow, Full Force, worked with Russell at Rush Productions for a while, and many other things. But I'd love it if you would just share a few words about Rocky.
Well, you know, in the era after the Sugar Hill Gang record, there were a lot of opportunities for people to jump into what hip hop was. And Rocky was a guy who'd been had been writing reviews for Billboard as well as working in other capacities there and was a real music guy. He really was one of the first adults who was honest, I'll phrase it that way, who liked the music, who thought it had some legs, and went out and paid attention to and listened to Eddie Chiba and listened to Kool Herc and sort of finally zeroed in on Curtis Blow as an artist to make a record with. It was just, you know, it was very, it wasn't really until the mid 80s that a lot of adults who had a lay, who really believed in part of the R&B world really paid any attention or had any belief in it. And maybe even later than that. So he was a singular person who saw Curtis Blow as a possible star. He's the one who told Curtis that he should use Russell Simmons as his manager, even though Russell was his promoter and his classmate. He saw that Russell could be more than just a guy giving parties. He, throughout his career, was a behind-the-scenes mentor to a lot of great talent. I mean, it's a funny thing. At least anybody remembers House Party, the great funny movie, Reggie Hudlin. He's the reason that Full Force are the villains in that movie.
Oh, wow.
Because even though they were musicians, they were big guys that had a very kind of comical side to them. He recommended them to Reggie Hudlin, and they ended up playing the villains and started a whole nother career for them. Those are just a few examples of a guy. He's one of those people who's not famous. He's not a household name, but he was a key cog in that era of between Rapper's Delight and Sucker MCs. He was one of the people who believed in art, who believed in hip hop, believed in rappers as stars. And made a lot of the better records from that era, particularly Christmas Rapping and The Breaks.
When we were talking for the obituary, one of the things we were talking about is, you know, hip hop, post Sugar Hill Gang, but really up through 1983, hip-hop as we now understand it was still very, very much reckoning with the long tail of disco. It had not developed a complete standalone sonic identity that was musical. Obviously connected to DJing, that was a very particular approach. But in terms of a production ideology, it hadn't totally arrived at it yet. And he was a person who was really hand-holding the genre as it was inventing its sound in real time through Larry Smith and everybody.
Larry Smith is important here because Larry was a friend of his. When I met Larry, he was playing like, you know, wedding bands, and he was doing, you know, different gigs like that as a bass player out of Queens. There's a whole community of musicians in Queens. Denzel Miller and Eddie Martinez all played on all the early Curtis Blow and the Run DMC records. So Larry was a bass player. He helped write the bass line on the Breaks and also Christmas Rap. And he was part of that team. And then he worked with Russell and they co-produced Sucker MCs, It's Like That, and the early Run DMC records, the first probably, I think he and Larry co-produced the first one or two Run DMC records. And then he went on to do something. He went on to produce Houdini. And it was Houdini, I feel like those records he made with Houdini, he found a way to keep it beat connected, but a production sound heavy on synthesizers that really was both radio friendly, but it definitely wasn't disco. It was definitely some other movement forward. And so Larry was someone that would never have been involved. He was, you know, Larry was trying to make his way into the studio. It was through the Curtis Blow records he got his leg in. Through the Run DMC records he got the credits. And through Houdini, he finally found his voice. And that was also, again, he was another person who came through Rocky, and Rocky gave him the opportunity to find himself.
I had not listened to the early Full Force records in a really long time. And then after we talked, I went back and listened to them, and I just, it's funny in a lot of ways for me with the Rocky Ford stuff. The Full Force records really kind of tied a lot of things together because you saw him holding on to some of the R&B ideals of the 70s, but accepting that hip hop had radically reframed the sonic palette that young people were pursuing. I was so happy to keep the description that you had of Rocky, where you're like, he wore saddle shoes. He still had his afro from the 70s. You know, he wasn't trying to be a young rap cat. That's not who he was. But he was savvy enough to understand how to hybridize what he was into with things as they were changing.
Yeah, he was he was a big music guy. So like, because he was at Billboard in the 70s into the 80s as a reviewer, you know, he went to see Eddie Palmieri a lot. He went to see rock bands. He covered, because it was very, Billboard was really cool that way. I reviewed everything. I reviewed Hot Tuna, goddammit. I reviewed Ted Nugent in Madison Square Garden, a show that I will never forget. You got to see a lot of stuff at Billboard because it was a trade pub, and it was about, is this an act that's saleable, you know, the kind of questions they asked at Billboard. So he brought all that to bear on a lot of those records. Like, I mean, I was saying that some of the musicians who played on the early Curtis Blow records, John Tropea, who was a big part of the New York session guitarist, is a guitar player on the Breaks, and the guitar is a huge part of that record. T-Bone Walk, who went on to play with Hall & Oates and then was also in the Saturday Night Live band, I think he plays on Christmas Rapping and maybe the Breaks as well. So he was using top New York session cats and on these records. So it was very much, he had a very strong sense of what a good groove was. Now, it wasn't necessarily what everyone in the park was playing in hip hop, but he was bringing that sensibility and trying to figure out how to meld those together. And I think that was the challenge, is that Sucker MCs comes out, and Sucker MCs is really born somewhat of the frustration that Larry and Russell Simmons had with some of the Curtis Blow production. Because they wanted to make something that felt more like the park stuff that was going on.
And those Curtis Blow records, you know, when I talked to Curtis, when I finally got him on the phone for the piece, you know, one of the things that Curtis remembered very fondly, but I think at the time was a source of some consternation, is, you know, they're like quasi-country records. There's R&B. You know, there's all these kind of, I don't want to say experimental. They weren't like abstract, but they were like, what would happen if we meshed A with B? Okay, we'll do a song like that. And a lot of the Curtis Blow, especially second, third, fourth albums, there are these moments where you're like, okay, that's an interesting idea. I don't know if it totally lines up with anything that's actually happening out in clubs or out in the parks, And I think as those Curtis Blow records were so prominent, I can understand why when Run DMC comes along, they want to do something that basically blows that out of the water.
Well, listen, you remember, I think it's on the first album. There's a song called Daydreaming, and it's Curtis singing. It's a ballad. So there's a direct line from Daydreaming, Curtis Blow, I Need Love by LL, all the way to Drake. I mean, that
absolutely,
that idea of how do we take the sex appeal of a rapper and bring some romantic love man stuff to it. So it's very funny because those records actually, oh, you're right, they are experiment. I mean, it is country and western. There's also one of my favorite records they made was there was a go-go song called Party Time. And that was inspired by them going down, Curtis playing at the Capitol Center. They were the headliner, but they did not realize how big Go-Go was in D.C. And I think Trouble Funk came on, or Experience Unlimited, and, you know, tore the roof off the damn place. And then he had to come on with his band, and it was like crickets. So they said, well, we need to adapt that. And actually, it's another interesting thing. We talk about these threads. That Go-Go beat, swing beat that came out of Go-Go that they did on Party Time, maybe 3 years later or 4 years later, is one of the backbones of New Jack Swing, except it's played through the computer. So a lot of what those Curtis Blow records were in retrospect, were these experiments about what can we do with this form?
Right, because there were no rules at that time. There just genuinely were no rules. Well, look, I appreciate you talking about Rocky and being able to honor his life. I'm glad we got a chance to chat about him a little bit, you know, to set this up, of course. And thanks for taking us back to the early 80s and the perennial debates about Urban, a word which appears to have outlived all of its usefulnesses. That's Nelson George. Hey, man, thank you. I appreciate it.
Take care, guys.
For J.C. Cribbs, we've touched on some of these books. Let's just recap, not to be all reading list about it, but these are great resources. Nelson's book, The Death of Rhythm and Blues, with the very intense author photo on the back. William Barlow's Voiceover, The Making of Black Radio. These are books that tell the story of all the things that we sort of take for granted in radio as being the system that's always been there. Really, it's the product of active decision-making from the 60s, 70s, and 80s onward. These tell some of that story. Also, we didn't get to talk about Jack the Rapper. You know, if you are of a certain hip-hop generation, you're familiar with Jack the Rapper, the convention before it got shut down. But Jack the Rapper was a conference that happened for a long time prior to the getting shut down in the early 90s. And there is a book that we also didn't get to talk about. It's As Told To by Jack Gibson, who is Jack, the Jack of Jack the Rapper. And it's just a lot of stories, a lot of firsthand experiences, and really of a golden era in radio and radio conventions. It all seems like much flashier and like much more fun and luxurious than what I would imagine such a convention would be like these days. So check that out. It's called Mellow Yellow, The Incredible Life Story of Jack the Rapper. And one other thing, this is not a J.C. Cribbs, but it is something that I do feel that we should chat about. We're starting to see a lot of artwork come out. There's a lot of protest songs that are coming out, and also murals and real life artwork. And I wanted to point people, especially if you're in New York, I wanted to point people to one particular thing that has been very striking to me. You may know Espo. Espo is a graffiti writer from Philly, lives in New York. Steve Powers. Espo has done a mural, and it's a mural. It's a Black Lives Matter mural, and it is in Union Square. And it looks incredibly powerful, includes many names of Black victims of police violence, of gun violence, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Michael Stewart, Sean Bell, Philando Castile, so on and so forth. If you're in New York and you're near Union Square, you should go check that out for sure. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with any questions. Also, check out the Facebook group where we will be talking about these things and more. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. And as we take you out, I want to take you out with a song my full force that Nelson and I were talking about when it comes to Rocky Ford. You know, I was really excited to go revisit those Full Force albums. And so I think it'd be good to kind of remember this is, it feels like a slightly lost moment, a lost period that hasn't been fully appreciated. And so let's listen to a single off the first Full Force album as we go. This is Girl, If You Take Me Home.
Girl, if you take me home. My heart just won't.